This weekend starts right after this.
As a small business owner, you need protection for your physical and financial assets. From general and professional liability insurance to business owners and commercial auto policies, GEICO can help. Go to geicocommercial.com for your free quote and see how much you could save today.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend, with your host, Gordon Deal.
Dangers of reverse mortgages. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
An investigation has found that nearly 100,000 loans that allowed senior citizens to tap into their home equity have failed. Hear where the problems are.
As Americans buy more SUVs, the days seem numbered for the old minivan. You'll hear the recent sales numbers.
For Father's Day, a number of restaurants are offering discounts for Dad. We'll run them down later in the hour.
What if these so-called knowledge boxes on Google are wrong?
They've had real trouble trying to fix it and have found that a lot of business opportunities may have fallen through or have they're getting a lot of weird questions. One opera singer was saying that she spent 14 months trying to scrub her ex-husband off of her panel, so it can get personal.
Wall Street Journal reporter Shalini Ramachandran on trying to fix Google's knowledge boxes, which aren't always so knowledgeable. Her report in about 25 minutes. In a stealth aftershock of the Great Recession, nearly 100,000 loans that allowed senior citizens to tap into their home equity have failed, blindsiding elderly borrowers and their families and dragging down property values in their neighborhoods. In many cases, the worst toll has fallen on those ill-equipped to shoulder it, and that's urban African Americans, many of whom worked for most of their lives, then found themselves struggling in retirement. It's an exclusive story by Nick Penzenstadler, investigative reporter at USA Today. Nick, what have you uncovered?
So these loan products really took off in the 2000s, especially as home values were rising. It's a kind of a unique product where seniors 62 and older can tap into their equity. So you don't have to own your home outright yet. You can still have a forward mortgage, take out one of these loans, tap into what you've already paid off, into what maybe your home has accrued in value, with the idea that you can kind of age in place and use that money to keep in your home as opposed to maybe downsizing or selling it. But the problem occurred in those late 2000s when the lending really accelerated and there was a gap between what the industry calls an ideal borrower that has kind of a diversified, well-researched retirement and someone who's kind of borrowing as a last resort. And we're kind of paying the price today for it.
All right. So what has happened here? What went down to really make things a mess for some of these families?
Well, it kind of depends on who you ask, but it part of the problem was miscommunication about the loan obligations. So yes, it eliminates your monthly mortgage payment, but you still have to live in your home, pay your taxes, your property insurance, and maintain the property. And if you miss one of those requirements, like particularly if you fall behind on your property taxes, your lender or servicer can very quickly push you towards foreclosure, where it's kind of the unnatural end to these that ended in a default, where you did not live out your time in your house and kind of age in place, but you are being removed from your home because something went wrong along the way.
And it seems like in a couple of these scenarios, and maybe I'll point out this this elderly gentleman from Philadelphia, 86-year-old Leroy Roebuck. He missed or forgot about his homeowner's insurance payment, and that led to sort of this incredible spiral. He couldn't make that up somehow.
Yeah, and part of the problem, this was, again, these compounded problems years ago where, say you missed one property insurance payment, and if you didn't realize it, sometimes the lenders would make the payment for you and then not notify the borrower and roll it into the loan balance, which is what happened in Mr. Roebuck's case. So Bank of America took out a property insurance policy and rolled it into his insurance and charged him interest on it, and before long, you know, the balance kept growing to where he couldn't get out of it and he had to file for bankruptcy.
Is there an effort to work with some of these folks to make sure that when something like this happens, they understand the steps to fix it? I mean, is it possible Mr. Roebuck just didn't take those steps and ignored them? I don't know what happened here.
There's a few things. So first of all, these loan products have improved as far as telling people up front what to expect as far as their obligations, making sure that borrowers are in a financial situation where they should be able to plan for using this money correctly. But we really are writing about this kind of middle cohort in the 2000s that didn't have those. And now, you know, 10 years later, they're having problems with them. But more to your question, yes, there should be some loss mitigation steps where you should be able to work with your servicer to try to work out a repayment plan, and there should be alarm bells going off before things get so bad that you're in this big hole. But we're finding that doesn't happen. Over and over again, advocates in this space have said the servicing of these loans is tremendously frustrating, where people can't get to a real person. Many times these loans have transferred lenders over the years. So maybe you started with Bank of America, you were used to Bank of America's servicer, and you've gone through three or even four or five different servicers since then that are sending you paperwork, sending you communications, and it's hard to get clear answers. And especially it's troublesome when there are tight deadlines that you need to fill things out and get it returned to them.
We're speaking with Nick Penzenstadler, investigative reporter at USA Today. He's written a piece entitled "Seniors Were Sold a Risk-Free Retirement with Reverse Mortgages. Now they face foreclosure." How widespread is this problem, Nick?
Well, it's all over the country. We were writing about 100,000 of these that are headed toward default or have gone through foreclosure. So it's obviously in areas where there are seniors that own their home and that were selling the product. So you can imagine pockets of Arizona in the retirement communities, many of these in Florida, California. But our piece also focuses on this cohort of urban black neighborhoods that were sold the product at a higher origination rate to begin with and now are suffering higher foreclosure rates. So we specifically wrote about Detroit, Philadelphia, Miami, Jacksonville. Those areas are particularly hard hit, and the number one zip code in our story is in the south side of Chicago. That's, you know, just through the roof with foreclosures.
Thanks, Nick. Nick Penzenstadler, investigative reporter at USA Today. 13 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend.
Michigan is one of the best places in the country to do business, but you don't have to take our word for it. Take Evan Lyles, CEO of Roush Enterprises, instead.
For the people that are involved in product development, there couldn't be more unique and exciting opportunities that are really going to shape the future of the world. It's a really exciting time to be in Michigan.
Big things are happening in business here. Find out why by searching Michigan Pure Opportunity.
Thanks for spending part of your Father's Day weekend with us. Once a tourism staple for many southern states and a few northern ones, destinations related to Civil War are drawing fewer visitors. Historians point to recent fights over Confederate monuments and a lack of interest by younger generations as a couple of the reasons. Wall Street Journal reporter Cameron McWhirter asks, is Civil War tourism history? Cam, what have you found?
You know, we looked at 1970 till now of the five major battlefield parks, but that's also, you know, the United States has grown by hundreds, you know, tens of millions of people at the same time. So it's even compounded even more. And what's happening is a whole bunch of things are happening. One is, as everyone can attest, we're all staring at our phones. Our kids are playing on video games. People just aren't going to parks like they used to. Secondly, there's less interest in history. And thirdly, and much more complicated, is this notion of how these parks, what these parks remembered and how they remembered the Civil War versus how they're trying to remember it now, and how museums and parks are trying to sort of reinvent themselves to include more of the voices of the war and explore more of the causes of the war instead of just, you know, General so-and-so was standing here at 3 o'clock on a Sunday and then Regiment X came by, you know, and really get into why there was a war as opposed to that there was.
Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, 950,000 visitors last year, 14% of what it was in 1970. Why, by the way, less interest in history? Anybody put a finger on that?
Everybody has a speculation. A lot of people are saying that we just don't teach it in the schools as much anymore. A lot of people saying also, you know, this war is a lot farther away for younger people than it was for my generation. You know, I'm in my 50s, so, you know, we grew up I didn't know anybody who fought in the Civil War, but your parents did,
right.
Your grandparents definitely did, and that's drifting away. So we're losing, there's much of one guy I spoke to who does a lot of reenacting said Civil War reenacting is really dying out, and there's a lot more interest in World War II reenacting and Vietnam reenacting, surprisingly, oh. And people who are going to be cowboys and just finding different ways to explore history, but not the Civil War, and also because it's a really touchy subject. Mm. There were a lot of things that we had this giant America's bloodiest war, and we didn't resolve a lot of things. And as we all can attest, with Charlottesville and Charleston being some of the more stark recent events, people are still trying to figure out what did the war mean? What did we fix? What did we not fix? What do we have to fix? What do we not have to fix?
Yeah.
And it's causing a lot of angst. So people would rather just go somewhere else.
Wow. We're speaking with Cameron McWhirter, reporter at The Wall Street Journal. He's written a piece entitled Civil War Battlefields Lose Ground as Tourist Draws. How are some of these parks trying to reinvent themselves?
A lot more discussion of other actors in the war besides just generals marching around. So focus on slaves, slavery as a cause of the war, the role women played, the role civilians played, the role politicians played, really looking at some of the actors that were ignored and instead there was a lot of focus on, brave guys running up fields, which not to take away from that. I mean, there's a lot of brave people who fought in the Civil War, but for a very long time, historians I was talking to were saying that was really the focus was, General X or Colonel X running up the hill instead of why they were running up the hill.
Yeah. Is there a danger of some of these parks shutting down?
No. These are national parks, so they're not going to shut down. They're just not getting the... I think there's probably some danger of museums shutting down. So, for example, the American Civil War Museum in Richmond just reinvented itself. It was a joining of two museums, one of which was called the Museum of the Confederacy. They got rid of that name, and that ticked off a lot of their former supporters, but they felt that they had to do that because you can't keep going with that name. I think there's a lot of concern about, museums all over the South, there were a lot of them, that used to have Confederate in their name, and they're getting rid of a lot of those.
Thanks, Cam. Wall Street Journal reporter Cameron McWhirter, who's based in Atlanta. 22 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend, when financial writers tackle the topic of spending, the result is usually all too predictable. Lectures on the dangers of lattes, right? The glories of budgeting and the financial apocalypse engendered by avocado toast. But one financial expert says it's better to focus on how your income gets divvied up among four key categories. Here's This Weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
If you want to get a handle on your spending, you need to focus on where your income is going. Joining us now to help sort it out, Jonathan Clements, a former personal finance columnist for the Wall Street Journal and the founder of HumbleDollar.com. Jonathan, what amount of money should we be trying to save each month?
Well, the rule of thumb used to be you should save 10% of your income towards retirement. I tend to say to people you should really be shooting for 12 to 15% towards retirement. Partly that's because expected returns to the financial markets are lower, and partly because you simply don't know what's going to happen in the years ahead. And if you save a little bit extra now, you'll be in better shape if you find yourself out of work later. One additional point to keep in mind, when I'm talking about 12 to 15% of your pre-tax income, I'm talking about the money that you're going to save for retirement. If you have other goals, you want to put the kids through college, you want to make a house down payment, that's going to be an additional sum on top of that 12 to 15%.
Jonathan, do you think most people are able to save that much?
I think everybody can save if they want to, but obviously the statistics suggest otherwise. The national savings rate remains low, and I think one of the big reasons is because of another category of spending. I often talk to people about what their fixed monthly costs are. And what we're talking about here are things like mortgage or rent, insurance premiums, groceries, utilities, cable bills, stuff like that. If these fixed costs are too high, you're going to find it really tough to save no matter how committed you are. As a rule of thumb, I suggest the people who are in the workforce should aim to keep their fixed living costs to 50% or less of their pre-tax income. If you can hit that number, you're going to give yourself a lot of financial breathing room. That means not only will you be able to save a lot of money every month, but also you'll have less financial stress because you won't be living paycheck to paycheck.
Jonathan, I think we've talked about this ad nauseum, but people often don't know how much they are saving and or spending on fixed living costs. How important is a budget?
You know, a budget is useful for people who don't have a good handle on how they're spending their money, but I sort of feel like, you know, budgets are rather like plans for dieting or plans for working out. Everybody loves the idea of having a plan, but the people who create those plans tend to be the people who struggle most with those various goals. You know, people who go on diets, in the end, tend not to lose weight. I think the best way to budget is simply to force yourself to save. Sign up for payroll contributions to your company's 401k or 403b plan. Sign up to have money pulled from your bank account every month and put directly into the mutual funds you choose. If you force yourself to save and then get yourself to live on whatever remains, you're far more likely to end up with money saved at the end of the month than if you try to meticulously track, you know, where every dollar goes.
We're speaking with Jonathan Clements, the founder of HumbleDollar.com. In very general terms, what are we paying in taxes?
So if you look at the statistics, in terms of federal income taxes, the typical family devotes about 14% of their income to federal income taxes. On top of that, if you're in the workforce, you're going to have to pay Social Security and Medicare payroll taxes. If you're an employee, that's going to be 7.65% of your income. If you're self-employed, it's going to be almost double that. So at that point, you're looking at sort of 14 to 15% of your income going towards payroll taxes.
And what happens in retirement?
Well, that's the good news of retirement. You don't have to pay those Social Security and Medicare payroll taxes anymore. You also obviously don't have to save for retirement at that point because you already are retired, but you will have to pay federal income taxes on things like withdrawals from your IRA or your 401k, and also when you sell any winning investments in your regular taxable account.
It's this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka with Jonathan Clements at HumbleDollar.com. 30 minutes now after the hour. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koshenka. Coming up this half hour, as Americans buy more SUVs, is the minivan headed for the junkyard? Also, spicy sauces right now are on fire from a sales standpoint. And free food and deals for Father's Day. We'll have a rundown for you in about 20 minutes. Google's algorithm wraps up people, places, and things into boxes that the company calls knowledge panels. The panels gather information from Wikipedia and many other sources on the internet. The panels once popped up for important historical figures and other famous people. Now they appear for all kinds of people. And when they contain significant mistakes, they can be difficult to fix. It's a story by Shalini Ramachandran, reporter at the Wall Street Journal. Shalini, explain.
Well, basically what Google's done over the last several years is it's tried to make its search more easily digestible by creating these panels, which are algorithmically done, that, you know, are about people, places, and things. But when it's when it was like Marie Curie and George Washington, you sort of said, oh, yeah, that's an easy way to figure out who they are and what they are up to. But over the years, their knowledge panels have started to incorporate kind of not very famous people, because their understanding of how you're connected to this and that and has increased. And so a lot of not very famous people have Googled themselves to find a panel on the right side of their search landing pages that's very wrong. And they've had real trouble trying to fix it and have found that a lot of business opportunities may have fallen through or have they're getting a lot of weird questions. One opera singer was saying that she spent 14 months trying to scrub her ex-husband off of her panel, so it can get personal.
How do the panels get incorrect in the first place?
Well, Google pulls in the information from various sources on the internet, so it's unclear. It's all algorithmically done, so it's not a human sitting there and curating them, and nothing is vetted for accuracy before it goes up on your Google landing page, unless you're a political candidate or a health disorder, but that's not a human being. But everything else is not vetted, and so
Incorrect information can come from Wikipedia vandalism, or it's just sometimes it's really baffling. Some people have wondered how the heck did Google find that, or same name issues. Have often gotten confused panels, like one Benjamin Reese, who's an English professor at Emory University, got confused with another Benjamin Reese, who was born in France. Who's a French cartoonist. So there's all kinds of ways you can all get messed up.
Right. Based on your story, it seems like getting Google to make corrections is difficult, especially a couple of folks you mentioned who were listed as dead who were not dead.
Yes, it can get really difficult. Google says that it's committed to verifying things fast, but it deals with a lot of... There's essentially a couple tools that it's offered people who have knowledge panels to get them fixed. One is this tiny, almost unfindable little button that says feedback. And if you click on it, you can try to start editing stuff. Unfortunately, many of the people I talked to say they were sending feedback for months and sometimes years and not ever getting a correction. So Google launched this thing a year ago. That's supposed to be so you can get verified by Google, so that you prove that you are who you are and this panel is about you. Now, that requires you sending a lot of personal stuff to Google, which includes your a selfie with a passport or a driver's license to Google. Or sometimes when the woman who was trying to get her ex-husband scrubbed was told by a Google employee she may have to send in her divorce papers. It can get really personal and private quickly. But during that process, Google verifies you. And once you're verified, theoretically, they elevate your feedback and correct things faster. But some people I've talked to have had a lot of problems even getting stuff fixed after they got verified.
Frustrating. Thanks, Shalini. Shalini Ramachandran, reporter at The Wall Street Journal. 21 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for being with us. Americans are saying no to minivans, once considered synonymous with suburban family life, even as the vehicle celebrates its 35th anniversary this year. In fact, Fiat Chrysler, whose Chrysler division is known for inventing the minivan, could soon kill off one of the segment's best-known models. More from Nathan Bomey, business reporter at USA Today. Nathan, a lot of models going by the wayside.
Yeah, I'd say about a dozen minivan models have been discontinued over the last decade and a half, and most recently the Nissan Quest going away after 2017, and you've got a few others that are sort of teetering at this point. The Kia Sedona doesn't seem to be in good shape. The Toyota Sienna is pretty popular among some people, but hasn't been redesigned in quite a long time. And Fiat Chrysler has confirmed they do plan to discontinue the Dodge Grand Caravan at some point in the next few years. So, you know, this is a segment that, you know, was invented actually 35 years ago. So the 35th anniversary this year of the minivan. This is a very functional vehicle. You know, and it had a really strong reason for flourishing, really, as, you know, the nation was still had a fairly high birth rate. But as the birth rate has declined, you know, you have families that are getting into, you know, more urban environments. They might want something that's a little bit easier to drive around. And the SUV boom is really starting to take the place of the minivan. And I think the tipping point here is recently we see several foreign automakers starting to introduce large SUVs. We're talking about three-row SUVs like the Kia Telluride, the Hyundai Palisade, and the Volkswagen Atlas. These are vehicles that we would not have seen from the foreign automakers a decade ago, but now they realize that there's an opportunity here. And if you're looking at a minivan versus a three-row SUV, you might end up with that SUV because, you know, there's still that concern about a stigma regarding a minivan, whether it's fair or not.
I mean, where's gas mileage these days? We always used to think of the SUVs as, you know, having the higher gas mileage than, say, a minivan.
Yeah, I think that that's actually one big reason why the SUV boom has really accelerated is because SUVs have much improved fuel economy from, you know, a decade or so ago when, you know, the automakers got in trouble because they had too many big SUVs, not enough passenger cars when gas prices spiked. Well, you know, at this point it's not the same. This is not your dad's SUV here. This is, you know, we're talking about vehicles that have decent gas mileage. I mean, not superb, but much improved from what they had 10 to 15 years ago. So, you know, if you maybe lose a couple miles per gallon after, you know, if you give up your car, you might be willing to do that because of the extra space and security that you feel in a large SUV.
We're speaking with Nathan Bomey, business reporter at USA Today, about his piece entitled Death of the Minivan, As Americans Buy More SUVs, Is the Minivan Headed for the Junkyard? Is it possible that this could boomerang and minivans make a return, or are we really looking at the end?
Yeah, that's the funny thing, is I actually do think there's a possibility that the minivan could make a comeback, but not in the form that we know it today. What I think could happen is when the self-driving car movement really starts to take off, we don't know when that'll be, but there's a good chance that the first applications will be minivans, because if you look at what Waymo is doing, for example, that's the former Google car company, they're retrofitting Chrysler Pacifica minivans to use as their initial self-driving cars. And that's because if you're going to hop into a minivan as a self-driving vehicle, you know, that's much easier to get in and out of than maybe an SUV or a mid-sized car, for example. So, you know, could we see the minivan sort of make a comeback as personal car ownership ends up on the decline? That's a possibility. But in the meantime, there could be some pretty lean years.
Are any of the minivans on really solid ground, like the Honda Odyssey or the Toyota Sienna?
Yeah, I think the Odyssey is in good shape. You know, Honda has really strong retail customer base. I don't think the Sienna is going anywhere either. Toyota, you know, doesn't get rid of models very easily, and so those are in good shape. But, you know, that Kia Sedona doesn't seem like it's in good shape, although they say that they're not going to get rid of it yet. And, you know, as I said before, the Dodge Grand Caravan is not in good shape either. Now, the Chrysler Pacifica has also had good reviews. You know, it came out to pretty good reviews from critics, and so since that's still relatively new, there's no reason to discontinue that anytime soon. But at some point, there may be a decision to be made about some of these models.
Thanks, Nathan. Nathan Bomey, business reporter at USA Today. It is 13 minutes now in front of the hour on this weekend. It's time now for a business update, and it's brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. The businesses of the future are being built today, and Michigan is where they start. Learn more by searching Michigan Pure Opportunity. From Mexican brands and Thai chili sauces to vinegar-laced styles rooted in the American South, consumers keep reaching for the condiments to satiate their desire for heat and flavor. Here's this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka.
The latest food craze, spicy sauces. As Micah Maidenberg of the Wall Street Journal tells us, we want Tabasco with everything. Micah, who's making these sauces?
All kinds of companies. One of the things that's really interesting about the hot sauce market is there's just a plethora of different types of companies, you know, from folks making it at home and maybe selling it at a farmer's market to some of the biggest food companies in the country.
Why is it such a big thing right now?
I think there's a couple of big kind of societal trends that are pushing it. One, younger consumers are into spicy foods. Why? Television shows like, you know, international travel shows, international travel, Instagram, social media. It's just people want spicier foods. And it's also like all the eating out that people have done at ethnic, you know, different restaurants. People are looking to like replicate those tastes at home.
Micah, your story talks about all kinds of different sauces and levels of heat. It sounds like there are hundreds of products to choose from.
Yeah, there are. I mean, there's definitely, obviously, some really like well-known brands out there. Frank's Red Hots has the biggest market share like in the space. Sriracha, very popular, really grown over the last like couple decades. Tabasco, of course, has been around for 150 years. Cholula, a large like Mexican brand, and then you have like folks, and I spoke with a gentleman from Panama, for example, who has been importing a Panamanian style habanero pepper sauce, and it's small, 35,000 bottles a year he's bringing over from Panama, but he's hoping to quadruple that over the next few years.
We're speaking with Micah Maidenberg of the Wall Street Journal. Is there enough money to be made in this market?
It's a good question. You know, hot sauce is like relatively inexpensive. That's actually one of the reasons why a lot of businesses like it and a lot of consumers like it, is because you can add a lot of like flavor to your food without adding, you know, without a huge cost.
You mentioned some of the companies that have been around for a very long time and a lot of the niche companies that are maybe family owned or something mm-hmm. very small. How does a company like ConAgra get into it, or why would they want to bother if there are so many players already there?
Well, ConAgra is an interesting example. They have a product called Rotel. It's, you know, basically canned diced tomatoes you might use in like a queso dip or, you know, cooking Mexican food, that sort of thing. And they're saying, look, we have this brand that's well known in different in a few parts of the country. We can extend the brand and its kind of identity into hot sauces, which consumers, you know, are looking for.
Bring it on. This weekend's Jennifer Koschenka with Wall Street Journal reporter Micah Maidenberg. 6 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend.
Michigan is one of the best places in the country to do business. But you don't have to take our word for it. Take Patty Poppes, president and CEO of Consumers Energy, instead.
All of the innovation that's occurring around robotics, AI, it's happening here in Michigan. We have chemical companies, we have pharmaceutical companies, we have medical device manufacturers. Michigan is a magnet for innovators and dreamers.
Big things are happening in business here. Find out why by searching Michigan Pure Opportunity.
Thanks for being with us. Need a Father's Day bargain for this weekend? People.com compiled some of the best restaurant deals. As always, you want to make sure to call ahead to make sure that your local store is participating. BJ's Restaurant and Brewhouse. Buy $50 worth of gift cards online at the BJ's website and get a $10 gift card in return. Bonefish Grill. Every dad loves bacon, right? Bonefish is offering a special bacon-filled meal deal composed of an 18-ounce bone-in ribeye topped with a Woodford Reserve bourbon bacon jam and served with a choice of two sides for $34.99 this Father's Day. Brugger's Bagels, buy one breakfast or lunch sandwich of equal or lesser value on June 16 and receive one for free. Carvel Ice Cream, on Father's Day, receive a Fudgy the Whale ball cap for free with the purchase of a Fudgy the Whale cake. And at Hooters, according to their website, Hooters is helping you give your dad a gift he won't have to pretend to like this Father's Day. June 16, buy 10 boneless wings for your dad and get 10 boneless wings for yourself for free. That'll do it for this hour. For Jennifer Koschenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend. As a small business owner, you need protection for your physical and financial assets. From general and professional liability insurance to business owners and commercial auto policies, GEICO can help. Go to geicocommercial.com for your free quote and see how much you could save today.